the complexities upon complexities of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict make a peaceful solution very hard, if not highly unlikely. In recent days, this news was on the ground with both Palestinians and Israelis, whose lives have to be balanced on the pretty non-negotiable differences in ideology and religion. In the Palestinian city of Ramallah, in the West Bank, we attended a briefing by Dr. Sabri Saidam of Fatah's Central Committee.
By the time I was introduced, three Palestinians would have lost their lives. Could well be women and children, and could well be adults. I have to say that since the resumption of the second round of attacks, almost 1,000 Palestinians have lost their lives. Now, people tell you that 50,000 Palestinians have been killed. I know Gaza quite well. I know it off by hand. I was there on the 3rd of October, 4 days before the 7th of October of 2023. Almost a year and a half, just exceeding a year and a half since the beginning of all this. And I have to say with honesty, I have never seen nor heard of 50,000 people being killed, according to modest figures. A whole territory the size of Singapore, totally flattened. 200,000 people injured. 40,000 children made orphans. The magnitude of firepower has increased since President Biden had left office. Not that Biden was a saint, but definitely firepower is extremely enormous, to the extent that you have seen people flying as they were bombed in Al-Arqam school in Gaza. Never seen in history. Figures that are coming and images that are coming out of a territory. And yet there is somebody who receives a standing ovation, receives red carpet treatment, and allowed immunity, and if anything else, is negotiating with other countries so that they withdraw from the International Criminal Court. The last of which has been Hungary, that has decided to receive Netanyahu, despite all the figures that you hear of. I wonder, ladies and gentlemen, if we are to exchange shoes, and those killed were Israelis, would humanity have allowed 50,000 Israelis to be killed? Would it have allowed an area of the size of Singapore to be eradicated? Would it have allowed the scenes that you have seen over months on end to transcend and make their way to you without moving a finger? We believe that we have been let down big time. We believe we have been betrayed. We believe that many of our friends on the popular level, humanity at large on the popular level, is with the Palestinians. But as far as the official ranks are concerned, we believe that we have been betrayed, forgotten, and gone unnoticed. We are definitely not the children of a lesser God. We are equal humans. And if anything, we continue to call upon the international community, guess what? To uphold international law, to implement UN resolutions, to allow two-state solutions to come into being. Although this is not a popular request and demand by many Palestinians who have given up on the peace process, have given up on the two-state solution, have given up on coexistence, but we still officially and on my level say that humanity would have to coexist. The humanity would have to come to terms with the ugly reality and pick up the pieces and push with life. And I think South Africa provides the best testimony to the irony of people to be able to come up with a solution that increases the proportionality of achieving coexistence. Is this doable? I wonder. Is this workable? I wonder. Is this something that humanity would ever entertain? I'm not sure. If you look at figures in Israel, many Israelis have been now wrote to believe that the coexistence is an unworkable formula. And this is not something that happened since the 7th of October. This is something that has been articulated, that has been masterminded, that has been formulated, that have been brought to the scene by Netanyahu, who has been in power for almost 30 years of preparations towards a scene where hatred becomes the rule of game instead of coexistence and ability to survive together. Israel is a country of technology. I am a man who comes from the technology field. Israel can be the country living by Palestinians. And today you would have been here not to discuss conflict, but rather to look at our shared innovation, our competence to reach the moon, our abilities to work on stem cells, our creativity in AI, artificial intelligence, and what have you. But sadly, for the last 50 plus years, you have been stuck in a conflict that you have heard about since you were at young age and you're still young. I am, as a human being, say that I have no remorse towards any Jew around the world. If anything, I say, you know, the very government of Israel is not necessarily representative of the many Jews around the world. And that's a call for them also, the enlightened Jews, to come to terms with the fact that the Palestinians are here to stay and that the policy of expelling Palestinians and throwing them behind the borders is not something that's going to work. We have been in the past asked to negotiate with Netanyahu, but Netanyahu persistently said that you negotiate without any finger raised, no conditions and no preset judgment. We said to Netanyahu at the time he wanted us to negotiate our pizza while it's being eaten. This territory, Netanyahu wants it to be more of a Swiss cheese kind of a territory, where he gets the cheese and we get the holes. Now, guess what? He does not want to even entertain that the facts, the holes continue to exist as a fact. He wants to eradicate the entire Palestinian nation. And make no mistake, what's happening in Gaza is what is happening in the West Bank. Although the scenario is different, although we have been, I would say, wiser in handling a situation that's very complex, but Netanyahu is persistently pushing for the end of Palestinian presence on this territory. I too have children, and they ask me about Gaza. They ask me about the home in Gaza, and I've not told them yet that our home in Gaza has gone. That my promise over the years to take them back to Gaza no longer stands. And I dare to think that there will be a day I can be able to fulfill the promise to my 12-year-old son, Jad, that I indeed can take him to Gaza. Friends, if there was no hope, humanity will not continue to exist.
Across the border in Jerusalem, I spoke to Haviv Gur, a political analyst and senior political correspondent for the Times of Israel. He had something to say about South Africa.
You think that Israel doesn't give a shit about South Africa taking it to the International Criminal Court. Why?
Israelis have a hard time believing the world's sort of moral debate about the war. And maybe they're justified, maybe they're not justified, but what it is that they see is a South Africa that had diplomatic relations with Assad, when Assad killed 600,000 Syrians. It's not whataboutist, it's selective outrage, right? We're seeing South Africa focus in on one place, one argument, and Gaza is suffering terribly, terribly. But that's not what a genocide is. There's actually a meaning to genocide. If genocide no longer actually involves the kind of mass death you had in Syria, Assad oversaw the death of something like 10 to 15 times the death toll in Gaza. And if the death toll in Gaza horribly, and hopefully it never does, but rises because the war returns in a big way, which I don't expect it to, but nevertheless, if that does happen, it'll take years of this to equal what happened in Syria. And South Africa has not taken Assad to the ICJ or the ICC personally or anything like that on any criminality. And I'm not just saying Israel's not as bad as Assad, so it's not bad. It is arguable that Israel fought badly in Gaza. And certainly there's a large civilian death toll, and so that question is important and legitimate and fundamental and should be asked. But this, you know, genocide and apartheid and colonialism, every bad word thrown at one country. And even when there are internal contradictions to these words, the definitions are changed to facilitate throwing them at this country. It's about something else.
Well, you seem to think that the bigger the backlash against Israel, the better for it. What is Israel's great strategy then going forward?
I don't appreciate the backlash. I don't like it. I wish it didn't happen. I wish the war was gentler and quicker. This is by far, by an order of magnitude, the bloodiest war Israelis and Palestinians have ever fought. And it's probably half the death toll of the last 100 years of war. It was for 100 years of Arab-Israeli wars, the totality of the death toll on all sides never reached, you know, 100-something thousand. This is one of the smallest death toll conflicts in the region. Gaza is the beginning, hopefully the end, but also the beginning of a different scale of death tolls. And a different fundamental strategy of Hamas that places civilians in harm's way to achieve much larger death tolls as a force multiplier for Hamas's forces. The Israeli strategy is trapped in that Hamas tactic of placing civilians at a scale. There have been many guerrilla forces that fought from within civilian populations and put civilians in harm's way, never on the scale of Hamas. Those tunnels, 500 kilometers of tunnels in a 25-kilometer territory, that's unprecedented in the history of warfare. And Israel's strategy has sort of evolved as it's tried to figure out what to do about this. And it seems to now have settled on the idea that Hamas has actually trapped Gaza more than it's trapped Israel. How do you rebuild Gaza? Even leaving aside Israel. Let's imagine Israel moves to Mars magically and Palestinians, deepest fantasies are all fulfilled in 10 minutes. How do you rebuild Gaza with Hamas in charge? Where does the money go? Where does the concrete go? It all goes to Hamas, right? And as long as there's anything left of Israel, it goes to the next war. And so nobody actually knows how to build Gaza again, just pragmatically, with Hamas in power. There's no dawn. There's no future for Gaza worth having as long as Hamas is in power. And that basic situation, Israel can sustain indefinitely. And so Israel has, watch out for this, and obviously I say this unless I'm mistaken in my analysis of the situation, but Israel has achieved what is quite likely the absolute victory without destroying Hamas. Because the only options left to the enemy are about the cost to Gaza of Hamas's removal. Hamas can choose whether the cost is high for Gaza of its removal or whether the cost is low, whether to leave or to stay. But it doesn't really have any other choices left. That's the Israeli success and strategy going forward. And it's one long tragedy for Gaza. In other words, I'm saying this in Israeli victory here, but it's not a flag-waving, dancing-in-the-streets victory. It's all tragedy. But it's still a victory.
Israel has a very powerful ally in the United States. In that relationship, who dictates the future of Gaza, Israel or the United States?
I think both want it to be both. Israel will have tremendous influence over the future of Gaza. I mean, even just leaving aside Israel's own specific needs in Gaza to make sure that a new Hamas doesn't take root, Gaza's future as a prosperous place depends on integration into the Israeli economy, on working with the Israeli economy, on producing with the Israeli economy. It is a simple and ironic fact that Hamas, even now, works in shekels. In other words, Hamas's regime in Gaza, as it seeks to destroy Israel, won't adopt the Egyptian currency, won't adopt, any other, right? It'll still work in the most stable currency around. So Hamas pays fighters. When it doesn't pay them in U.S. dollars brought in from Qatar, it pays them in little bills with Israeli poets and presidents on them, right? Gaza's prosperous future depends on Israel. So you can't do it without Israel. At the same time, Israel does want the international backing. There's tens of billions of dollars of rebuilding. And there's an education system to run in Gaza that de-radicalizes instead of re-radicalizes the population. And that's something that Israel can't do, right? Israel can't walk into Gaza and say, hey, please change your fundamental religion or ideology of your religion. It needs the Arab world. And it needs America to be that platform. And so everybody has to be in on Gaza, on building Gaza, fixing Gaza, and giving Gaza that much better future than anything Hamas could give it.
So how is this going to end, do you think?
What is the aphorism? People tend to do the right thing, but only after having exhausted all other possibilities. There's no future for Gaza with Hamas. We will sit around waiting for Gaza's future to begin until Hamas understands that. I'm not representing Israel in saying that. I literally can't see a way forward for Gaza at the most pragmatic policy level as long as Hamas is there. When that happens, then politics matters again. Then whether America is ruled by the right or the left, or Israel is ruled by center-left governments willing to coordinate more with the Arab world, or right-wing governments who want less coordination with the Arab world, will fundamentally matter for the future of Gaza.
So essentially, you're saying this is a waiting game, because earlier you did say that there could have been a genocide, but...
No, what I said was... Well, first of all, let me just... At a practical level, it is in military terms, that's a simple truth, and nobody doesn't say that. But my argument was Hamas needed, for its strategy to work, a much higher Gazan death toll. It is deeply frustrating to Hamas ideologues.
And but you haven't killed more.
That the Israelis have this defense, that the actual death toll in Gaza appears to be one combatant for every 1.5 or 2 civilians, which is a horrific tragedy, but also fairly in line with democratic military norms. America in Mosul had a 2-to-1, or 1.7-to-1, I think was the final analysis produced by scholars, 1.7 civilians to 1 military death. Well, if Israel in Gaza, given those tunnels, given that dense population, managed to achieve 2 civilians to 1, that is in keeping with democratic... No, that is not the Battle of Manila, where the Japanese killed 10-to-1. Right? That is in keeping with democratic army norms. If that's the truth of Gaza, the Israelis have a powerful defense. And that's frustrating to Hamas. And it is willing to sacrifice the Gazan population to achieve internationally and to achieve tactically on the ground victories against Israel. And so, yes, Hamas absolutely wishes there were more dead Gazans. Unquestionably. And by the way, just to give them the respect they have earned, including their own families. Ismail Haniyeh, the Hamas political leader before he died, had lost his own sons in the war and was proud of it. And so, yes, they are willing to destroy Palestine in order to destroy Israel, because they don't actually feel that they're fighting an occupation to achieve a better thing, for a better future for Palestine. What Hamas thinks it's doing, and there are many Palestinian factions, and they have different ideas and ideologies and visions of the future, but what Hamas thinks it's doing is seeking out a religious redemptionist ideology rooted in the Muslim Brotherhood, rooted in the idea of returning to the early generations of Islam and restoring Islam to its proper power in history. And Gaza is a worthwhile sacrifice, because it can't be achieved without pushing out the Jews. The Jews are the weakest thing that ever pushed Islam back, and therefore Hamas argue the first thing that Islam must overcome in order to return into history as a powerful agent in history. And therefore, destroying Gaza is a worthwhile sacrifice for the destruction of Israel. And so, no, Hamas absolutely are not interested. They don't care. They don't mind if Gaza has a good future. But the only good future worth having is a religiously redemptive, validated future. And so they're absolutely willing to destroy Gaza.
Just one last thing. What would happen if Israel pulled out of the West Bank?
At the moment, with no agreement, with no other power base, with no peacekeepers, with no negotiated set, just literally got up and pulled out like it did in Gaza in 2005. I think Hamas would take over. I think everybody else thinks Hamas would take over. I have never met a Palestinian who makes a serious argument in any data, any polling data, that it would not take over. The only thing that would prevent it from taking over would be Israeli military action. But then Israel hasn't fully pulled out of the West Bank, right? If Israel literally just pulls out and leaves that vacuum, as it did in South Lebanon in 2000 and in Gaza in 2005, I don't think there's any serious people who argue that Hamas would not take it over even now.
Up north, in another conflict zone, I spoke to Syria expert, Lieutenant Eyal Dror, the former commander of Operation Good Neighbor.
Colonel,
What has been happening in Syria is the fall of Assad, and how could that affect the future of Israel?
So since the end of November 2024, the Assad regime has been collapsed, and they have now a new government established by Mr. Jalani Shara, which is a Sunnite, not a Shiite. From the point of view of Israel, first of all, it is good for the Syrians that they liberate themselves from the dictatorship of the Assad regime. We were witnesses to the war crimes that the Assad regime was doing during the Syrian civil wars to its own people. On the other side, we have to think or to realize the meaning of the Ashara regime to Israel's safety. Ashara, he was the establisher of Al-Qaeda in Syria. He left Al-Qaeda, then they have the Hayat Tahrir al-Sham. Hayat Tahrir al-Sham is still an organization that a part of it is people of ISIS ideology, people with very extremist ideology, which make us to feel unsafe. It means that maybe it has been changed from a Shiite challenge, but to a Sunnite radical challenge for the border of Israel, and which you see that his good connections with Turkey and Qatar, which I remind the president of Turkey just in the last couple of years was praying for the destruction of Israel, you have to think about the concerns of the state of Israel from what is going on in the next month from this border.
What do you think Syria's strategy is now with regards to Israel?
So first of all, in general, the strategy of Ashara is I need a recognition, international recognition. This is why he cut his hair, is dressing in a Western way, let's call it like this, with ties and suits. And he's talking, I will call it, in a very moderate way. He needs international recognition. He needs the money that the world will put in order to rebuild Syria. It will cost hundreds of billions of dollars. So he also claimed that I have nothing against Israel. I don't want to have a war against Israel, which is good. For the first thing, I will say that he also, for example, mentioned that Israel will not longer will be called the occupation or something like that. He will call us by our name, Israel, which is something that make it good. However, I think that Israel, and especially after October 7th, we are tired from nice words. We need to see it by actions. If you are going with Turkey, if you are giving your country for the Turkey, and again, a country that said we want to make the Ottoman Empire again, Israel should be eliminated in it, it makes us to be concerned. So his strategy is, first of all, he doesn't want to confront against Israel because he knows that he doesn't have the power for that and need to put more effort in rebuild his country. However, I don't know if, or I'm not sure that he will not, by blinking, allow his terrorists to come closer to the border. And this is our concern. And this is what Israel should do now to prevent any kind of another 7th of October surprise.
That's why you believe it would be suicidal for Israel to lose this border.
So, first of all, we are now on the border. Israel now, from security thought, capture like a strip of 2 kilometers on the what has been called the demilitarized zone. Now, the audience should realize, back when it was a sub-regime, although we weren't with like peace agreements, it was an agreement between the two countries speaking about the demilitarized zone monitoring by the UN. This agreement has not existed. So until we will see a proof that he can sign an agreement, and even more important, because Hezbollah signed agreement with Israel and immediately made it opposite the agreement. Until we will see that he's signing an agreement and he has the ability to enforce the agreement, I do believe that Israel should stay there from security reason. It is not an occupation. We don't need the Syrian land. We need to take care for our safety.
On yet another front, we were briefed on the war with Hezbollah by Lieutenant Colonel Sarit Zahavi of Military Intelligence and the founder of the Omar Center think tank.
Each month, you About 300 attacks. It's a war of attrition. What's the logic behind it of Hezbollah? And as you can see, about half of the targets were civilian targets in Israel. Hezbollah deliberately used projectiles and rockets that are inaccurate in most cases. The weapon that it used mostly was rockets, and when it hits, it's da, 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 da. That's what you hear, da, 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 da. One after the other. It's more difficult to intercept when 30 rockets are launched at the same time. And the terrain here, by the way, is also more difficult to intercept. These rockets are not accurate. And since they are not accurate, Hezbollah can publish, as happened, by the way, in Majd al-Shams. Hezbollah published that he launched a missile against an IDF base. You saw the terrain above the soccer field, and it landed in the soccer field below. Because it's inaccurate weapon, they know they will threaten, and it's inaccurate, I mean, with kilometers away.
So it's not targeted?
It's not, it's allegedly targeted. If you can phrase it wherever you can, as long as, wherever, however you want, as long as we understand each other. Okay? I can tell you that when they use drones, when they use anti-tank missiles, this is much more accurate. This is an incident that a drone hit a community center in a community over here, by the way, a Muslim community. And in the community center, there were civilians and there were also soldiers there because it's a border community. It is, when I'm saying border community, I mean right on the border, okay? This community specifically is like the border almost across the community. And we had, I think, about 10 were wounded and one person was killed in this incident. And to the anti-tank missiles, we don't have any defensive answer because Iron Dome cannot intercept anti-tank missiles. We don't have the sirens before they are launched. They are for very short range, so we don't even have time. And every launch is a hit with the anti-tank missiles. When I'm talking about the drones, they can be intercepted. But again, when the alert is very short, like Rizov said, this place is very close to the border, so we didn't have time. And it is much more challenging to intercept the drones. After 11 months of, or 9 months, until September, of, how much is it? 11 months of defense that Israel attacked in South Lebanon, but attacked in South Lebanon in a way that didn't solve the problem, that was not an offensive. It was defensive attacks in order to either prevent an immediate threat, or kill those who just launch rockets against us. Things very, very specific. It means that throughout the day and night we heard blasts, we were like living in a war zone, but it was not a major offensive against Hezbollah. After 11 months, the Israeli government finally decided, after the killing of the Druze children and a few more incident, that the situation became, maybe I should go one slide before, became unbearable, also because the shooting to areas that are not evacuated. In October 8th, or even in October 7th, the people of the north, when they woke up to the news from the south, they knew immediately that it's going to happen to them. We knew that it's going to happen to us. We didn't know when it's going to happen, how it's going to happen. And in the first few weeks of the war, before we entered Gaza, the Iranians kept threatening that if we will enter Gaza, Hezbollah will invade into Israel. So the feeling was very realistic that it's about to happen. And that's why among the communities next to the border, which is 0 to 5 kilometers from the border, people packed their suitcases and left. And after a few days, the Israeli government issued an order to evacuate because nobody could promise us that Hezbollah will not invade and do exactly the same thing as Hamas had done to us in Gaza. And it became a situation that we had 43 communities, all the white things on my map, that that are evacuated, that's about 60,000 people, okay? You probably hear different numbers, about 60,000 people that receive compensation from the Israeli government until, you know until when? Until March 1st this year. So long. Not to come back to their communities, at first because of the fear of an invasion, then because of those anti-tank missiles that were launched to the communities and there is no answer, like what do? And then because of the rockets, it interrupted the lives of all of us, including those like myself, that are living further than 5 kilometers from the border and are not evacuated. And the trend is very clear here, that since June, those who are not evacuated have to run for shelter many, many more times. Now, it's very different from Tel Aviv. In Tel Aviv, what, to evacuate Tel Aviv? You don't evacuate Tel Aviv, right? What's the difference? Because in Tel Aviv, you have a minute and a half to get to the bomb shelter when you hear the sirens. I have 15 seconds. And I never made it on time. Unless I was next to the shelter. Next to the shelter, I mean, between here and there. That's it. We never make it on time. That, don't make it, what does that mean, never make it on time? It means that before I get to the bomb shelter, I hear the blasts. Scariest moment of my life is to hear those blasts above my head when I was with my little girl, outside, nowhere to run, no shelter, no nothing. I just had to lie on her. I was running to lie on her because we were in the car. You need to get out of the car and then lie down and then to lie on her. And I didn't make it on time. As a mother, that's the scariest moment of my life. And you hear the blasts above you and you see the smoke of the interception just above your head.
Meanwhile, on the Gaza border, the terror attack of October 7 has left communities in lasting trauma. One of the worst hits was on the kibbutz, Kfar Aza, where I spoke to Edith Tzudikovic.
They missed their father. I missed their father. He was 50 years old. 50.
He was one of how many people killed that day?
He was one of 64 people that I
killed
lost.
Here.
Only in Kfar Aza, 64 people. I've been to 8 funerals a day for 2 weeks in a row because I know everyone. They're all my family, my friends, the parents of my best friend, the son of my best friend. It's very hard to understand, and sometimes I don't even feel how come we became the bad guys. What do you mean? Look what they done here. They just went and did a very big massacre from one house to another. They raped women, they raped men. We found 2 people here without a head. They cut their head off. One of them was murdered with his girlfriend. I don't know if maybe they made her watch how they take the head off. We don't know because she got also murdered, but we don't know who got murdered first. We don't know how they tortured. We know that they tortured them because we found the body in very bad situation. So they burned some of the people.
How many hostages were taken from this kibbutz?
From this kibbutz, 19 hostages were taken. They released the women and the children after 51 days. And now, and then they released, there was another release. 2 of them got died. They got murdered over there. But 2 are still there. Gali and Ziv Berman, twins, 27 years old. They were born 3 days after my son, so I know them quite well. I raised them with their mother together. The most funniest people, the most happy people, and we cannot bear the thought that they're going to die there. Because we don't know anything. We don't know anything what's going on with them.
Now, from what you've told me earlier, the terrorists seem to have had brilliant intelligence. They knew exactly where to go, even where the armory was. Why do you think they were able to gain such brilliant intelligence?
I think we underestimated them. They took many of the information from Google, from the net, from everywhere, but we also know for sure, it's not assumption, we know for sure that people from Gaza that used to work here gave the Hamas information. We know it because we investigated those people. We have the names, but they're not from the Hamas, but they gave information to the Hamas. So yes, we know for sure, because otherwise you cannot know such details of who lives where, who's in the occupation of each one of the people. They knew things that you cannot know from the net. You know it from inside information from their people.
And when the civil guard tried to defend this kibbutz, how many of them were slain?
The civil guard is the first group of people that came, but they were waiting for them in the armory. They made the ambush, and seven out of 12 got murdered. And the others just couldn't approach because they saw what's going on. If you came a little bit late, you got saved that day. Everything was a matter of timing. And all the people that came first didn't survive. The people that came a little bit later saw that you cannot survive if you approach such a zone. So they just went away and tried to help from outside.
What message do you have for both the Israelis and the Palestinians today?
I want the Palestinians to release our people, our citizenship, and then we can talk about the future. Until they are not here, I don't want anything to do with them. I don't want to... You know, I felt differently before October 7. I used to think about this mother in Gaza, like me, have four children, want to have decent meal on the table in the evening, and, you know, have peaceful life, coexistence. I'm sorry, but after what they did on October 7, I don't want anything. I cannot think about this mother because I don't think she think about me. But bring our hostages back. This is not the way to have an arrangement and agreements. This is not the way. Bring them back to us, and then we'll figure all the rest later. Bring our people back.
A memorial park has meanwhile been erected on the Nova Music Festival site, where I spoke to survivor Rita Yedid.
You endured 8 hours of terror next to your husband, who had been shot 3 times.
Yes.
What is your most dramatic memory from those hours?
Okay. I think that the most traumatic event at that time is probably the understanding that I'm not going back to my son, who is waiting for me, who is only 2 years old, that both of his parents are in a very bad situation. My husband was laying on top of me, wounded with 3 bullets. I'm not coming out of it. My husband is not coming out of it. Being, you know, I was laying next to my sister and just understanding that my mom will need to face all of it. I think that's the most traumatic moment at those moments.
And then the most bizarre thing happened. You thought you were about to be rescued.
I thought I will be rescued. And I thought a policeman came to the front window and I asked him about, you know, security forces. And he said, no, you need to give me your phone and money. And phone and money was someone, an Arab from Gaza, that came to rob us. He walked, no weapon, no nothing, just a civilian. And understanding that civilian, you know, undercovered us. And he will call now to his fellows from Gaza and they will come to murder us. That was bizarre, definitely.
And when you were finally rescued, the scene of horror that awaited you.
Yes. You know, when I saw them, the Israeli soldiers finally come to rescue us at 2 p.m. that day, after it all started at 6:30 a.m., I thought, that's it. The worst is behind me. Finally, I've been rescued and I can go home to my baby. I even called my mother at 2:06 and screamed on the phone, Mom, I'm alive. But at the same moment, I thought that it was the end of all terror for me. I came out of the caravan and I saw so many bodies and so many dead kids and so many kids of someone that couldn't call anymore to their parents and let them know they're on the way home. So for me, it started this way. Like, that was another start. That was another start of being guilty for staying alive. And for me, that day ended up with breastfeeding my son at 8 p.m. in the evening. And again, I kept being for such a long time between the idea I'm alive and maybe I'm giving the worst for my child right now. And maybe I'm alive, but so many others don't.
From the way you spoke, there was a Rita that existed before October 7th, and there is a Rita now.
Yes.
A very different person.
Right.
What's the most, or the biggest difference about you?
I think that, I think that the biggest difference is that I am way more appreciative of what I have. I have way more faith in God and in the creation, that I'm not here. I'm not a decision maker. And things are not happening to me. I'm not a victim anymore. I'm the creator of the things that are happening to me. And even a thing like Nova happened for my best interest, for me to grow, for me to be able to prosper, and maybe even to find my mission in life. So that's me now. That's the different me. I no longer look at what I was. I actually, you know, tell, okay, whatever I was. From October 7th, it's a new me. I'm acceptable of more things. I surrender more easily.
Earlier, we spent time with you in a healing ceremony, writing down the things we are all grateful for. And that was very focusing for us, too.
Thank you.
But if you could write a message to your attackers, what would you write to them?
I won. I'm undefeatable. And you can be haters and you can be very bad to me, but you will not win. And I am strong and standing, and I will dance again.
Back in Tel Aviv, former Knesset member Ruth Wasserman Lande, who also advised former President Shimon Peres and was a former deputy ambassador to Egypt, spoke about how her focus is beyond the conflict between Gaza and Israel and is firmly on Iran. She also has something to say about South Africa's relationship with that country.
Good, decent people in South Africa. Okay? I don't need to tell you, you know better than me. The government of South Africa has sold many of its assets, whether we like it or not, it's politically correct or not, to the Islamic Republic of Iran, and many of its debts. Hence, the Iranians hold the South African government to some extent, not a small extent, accountable to it and its interests, not the interests of the South African people, that many still suffer economic issues, destabilization, issues of infrastructure, and again, politically correct or not, we all know that it's true, okay?
But where is the evidence of that?
The evidence that many people in South Africa don't have what they deserve?
The assets that they sold to Iran.
Well, there are certain agencies that do intelligence-related work that is economic. Okay. Every once in a while, statements are being made. For example, the head of intelligence in the United States has said after October 7th, as if for us Israelis, it was hello, good morning, obviously, but this was a statement made by the United States, that the Iranian Islamic Republic of Iran was funding a lot of the demonstrations against Israel. Lo and behold, there weren't spontaneous demonstrations. There were pre-organized demonstrations that very, very, very surprisingly began before Israeli IDF even went into Gaza after our people were raped, massacred, and murdered. And there were suddenly all these demonstrations all over the place, poof, 2 seconds after the attack. So this is one of the issues that came out. But likewise, other issues came out regarding the relationship between the Islamic Republic of Iran and the South African government. And these are difficult allegations that I'm making, and I stand behind them. Not politically correct allegations, but there is a lot to be done for the people, a lot of the good people of South Africa, and there is a relationship between those two countries. And I will go even further to say that this is the reason why the South African government went to the ICC and stood against Israel in the International Court of Law, and not because the people of South Africa have an issue with Israel, the Holy Land, and or the Jewish people. I don't believe that personally. What is it, this obsession about Israel? So, I mean, let's be real. I mean, Israel is, I mean, they always speak about Israel. There has to be something. I mean, let's not pretend that this is a, we are not on the moon. What do we have in Israel that's really, really?
Jerusalem.
Exactly. We have the diamond. What does Saudi Arabia have?
Mecca.
Saudi Arabia is a Sunni stronghold. The Shiites want something. What can they have? Saudi Arabia has Mecca and Medina. Mm. What can they have? Al-Quds. Mm. Al-Quds al-Sharif. You just say that, boom, all the Muslims in the world stand up. If you say to the news...
Sorry, say that again. If you say what?
Al-Quds. Al-Quds in Arabic is Jerusalem.
All right.
Okay? Al-Quds, you don't need to do much. You just say Al-Quds, boom. Every single Muslim on the face of the planet will stand up ready. For what? For jihad. All you need to do is say the Israeli army is occupying and not allowing Muslims to pray. Is it true? God bless you. Please come and see. In Ramadan, you came exactly after Ramadan, Eid al-Fitr, how many hundreds of thousands of Muslims are praying, whether it's a right-wing government in Israel that doesn't want this, or a left-wing government in Israel. It makes absolutely zero difference.
Praying in Jerusalem.
In Haram al-Sharif, in the holiest of holies. In fact, if I go as a Jew, do you think they're going to let me in? My government. No. No, they won't. Because this is a holy time for the Muslims, and in Ramadan, and there are pictures to prove this, but don't confuse me with the facts, right? If now the Hamas will shout, and they do this every single Ramadan, except now because they're busy being at war with the IDF in Gaza, but every single Ramadan, you have the Hamas yelling on the top of their voices to every media outlet, the Israeli army is preventing the Muslims from praying. Is it true? No. But who gives a shit,
this
right?
This is Al-Aqsa.
Al-Aqsa, because hundreds of thousands of people are praying. But that doesn't make a difference, because you just need to say the word. Al-Quds, poof! Every single Muslim stands on his or her feet. Why? Because it's the diamond. It's very important. So who wants it? Everyone. When the Hamas attacked the southern parts of Israel, what did they call the attack?
Al-Aqsa.
They called it Tufan Al-Aqsa. What is Tufan? It's when the sea, what do you call this? Mabul.
A flood
of Al-Aqsa. Mm-hmm. What does Al-Aqsa have to do with the raping and the massacre and the burning of women and children and grandmothers in the southern part of Israel, where every single person is a peacenik, a left-wing peace advocate? Yes, none of them vote for Bibi Netanyahu. What does it have to do with it? Absolutely nothing. They wanted a name to explain that they are going to liberate what? Al-Aqsa. When Erdogan in Turkey speaks about Israel, what does he say recently? I will liberate Al-Aqsa. What does he have to do with Al-Aqsa? What does Gaza or the West Bank have to do with Al-Aqsa? With liberating Al-Aqsa? Nothing. Absolutely zero. Nothing. Okay? When Julani's people that are misbehaving and not listening to him because he's trying to be nice to the West for foreign investments and to put on a suit, before he was Al-Qaeda, but now he put on a suit and he says to the world, I am a real serious head of state. But some of his people are not listening. and they say, we will liberate Al-Aqsa. What do these Syrian people, or some of them are Chechen and not even Syrian, they come from all over the place to fight in jihad in Syria against the Shiites, the Alawites, the Assad family, that were very bad to their people, by the way, okay? But they want to liberate Al-Aqsa. Why? Because Al-Aqsa is the diamond. This is the power. This is something that can really stand opposite Mecca or Medina. This is a real significant something in your hands, that with this you can lead the Islamic Ummah, the nation, okay? And I just wanted to tickle a little bit your framing, because we are fed a lot of bullshit in international media, and a lot of us don't know. Even, I'm telling you, most Israelis are talking about the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. They're talking about a state, a nation state. Now, I'm telling you, as an expert in the minds of terrorist organization, by the way, designated terrorist organization Hamas, not by Israel, by America, by the UK, by France, by many countries in the world, Hamas and Hezbollah is a terrorist organization, okay? And when I'm telling you that they are not interested at all in a nation state, because their frame of mind is religious. Islam, it's creating the greater worldwide Sharia-based caliphate. And they are not shy about it. This is not Ruth Wasserman Landes saying. They say it. They say it in Arabic openly. Okay? Openly. They don't hide this issue. And it's not hard to check. It's online. When they did what they did on the 7th of October, and I imagine that you were in a place or two, or had they went, yeah? You can't even make something like that up. I mean, it was so bad. God only, I mean, this, I don't know. When they did what they did, it wasn't in order to create a Palestinian state. They called the people that voted for the left in Israel and that schlepped in their cars to hospitals children from Gaza, because they're left-wing people believing in peace, and they brought the workers from Gaza, because there were many work permits and many Gazans work in their homes in the kibbutzim in the south. Okay, these people, when the Hamas did what they did, it wasn't in order to create a Palestinian state, okay? Because these villages and kibbutzim are not in that state, right? I mean, when people in the West talk about the state, they mean Gaza, not the south of Israel, and the West Bank. So what does it have to do with the kibbutzim in the south of Israel? Nothing. And they called them mistautanin. What is mistautanin? Does anybody speak Arabic here in this room?
No.
Mitnachalim, settlers. Like they are, if there were any Jews in Gaza, there would be settlers, okay? Like they call the Jews living in some places in the West Bank, settlers. So the people that live in Tel Aviv and me and the people in those kibbutzim are also settlers, because it's nothing to do with the state. The idea, the concept of a nation state is not a religious concept in Islam. The Hamas is an Islamic religious organization, okay? They are looking for something else, not a nation state.
Meanwhile, the war has nuked the tourism industry. In Tel Aviv, I spoke to Daniel Cedar, the man regarded as the very best travel guide in the region.
So how has the tourism industry been affected? Badly, obviously, but how badly?
So tourism pretty much died. On October 8th, all of my, everything that I had booked was completely canceled for the rest of the year. And unfortunately, we got sort of used to that during COVID, which was also a rough time for tourism. And in Israel, every couple of years, we have some sort of a small war or a small struggle. And then that always, the first thing that gets affected is definitely tourism. The only groups that came here from October 7th and on are groups, either delegations, people who came here to see the war, to talk about the war, journalists, diplomats, etc., etc. And there were quite a few people who wanted to see how they could help. So, especially from the Jewish community in America, people came here for solidarity, to see where the massacres took place on the southern border with Gaza, to see how they could help, how they could donate money, how they could start. Many projects were started with tourists that came here, saw the atrocities that happened, and decided, for example, to donate shoes to a certain army unit, right? Or to build shelters in a certain communities, etc., etc.
The situation is volatile, so it would be hard for you to predict when tourism is going to recover, if it's going to recover, how it's going to recover, but I know you are optimistic.
Yeah, it's hard to know. It's hard to know what's going to be. The Middle East is a place that's very, very dramatic. You know, you go to sleep at night, you don't know what news you're going to wake up in the morning, right? And so even if people plan to come here now, you buy your ticket now, in 2 months, I don't know what Israel's going to look like in 2 months. Look, we in Israel, we're sort of used to this status of war, but we try to put it aside and live our daily life. And I think that in the daily life, we don't really have that differences between Jews and Arabs, mm-hmm. between Muslims and Christians, between Jews. It's when you at the end of the day, when you go to the supermarket, right, the guy that works and cleans the place might be a Russian Jew, right, and the cashier might be an Arab, and you would have people from all sectors of the society, and no one really cares where you come from, what your accent sounds like. We all basically try to get along, and I would say that most of the times it works. There are more stressful times in Israel, and we do have a lot of issues and problems, but at the end of the day, coexistence in Israel is something that happens on a daily basis. If you want a best example for that, is just go to an Israeli hospital. Israeli hospital, we've got a large percentage of Arab doctors that work here. And when you go in to get treatment, you really don't care who your doctor is and who the nurse is. And the doctor doesn't care if you're Jewish or if you're Christian or if you're Muslim. They're there to save lives. And that's what they're going to do. And I think that it's beautiful.
These are but a few of the many voices of people we spoke to in Israel and Palestine. What does the future hold for the Middle East? What will the new Middle East look like? Nobody has the answers. I'm Christine for this news.